sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. A place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. Let us take time in the center of our service and the center of our lives to attend to life's quieter moments, the moments between the words and behind the lines. You may use these first moments for lighting candles of memory and hope, or just sit quietly, remembering who you are and why you are here. The theologian Howard Thurman said, "Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs are people who have come alive." It sounds easy, but it often seems hard. Let us focus on what makes us come alive. Let us seek to live within stories that know our true name, and to those places where we feel safe, real, and cherished. Let us seek them as well and learn to dwell near them. Let us muster the courage to listen for those voices that demand only the best from us, and let us grow comfortable in their company. For they are angels of our better nature, and we need to put ourselves in the company of the angels of our better nature. For our calling is a high one. We are made, as scientists and poets alike have told us, of stardust, of the stuff of the universe and the gods are we made. And that noble origin grants us honor and a task. The task begins with asking what makes us come alive and going to do it. Because more than anything, that's what the world needs, people who have come alive. Let us seek and serve that which makes us come alive. Nothing less. Amen. I'm going to talk about stories this morning in the next few weeks, so let me begin with one. Once there were people who lived in a valley at the foot of a large mountain, and high up on top of the mountain, they said, there was a face, a great face carved in the stone. The people said it was the face of a god, and if you could see that face clearly, they said, it would show you who you were and who you were meant to be. It sounded easy, but it was not, for the face was in part of the mountain that was inaccessible. You couldn't climb there, and you could never see it clearly. It was always partly obscured by fog or clouds. Furthermore, the face seemed to look different in different light. And no two people ever saw it quite the same. But it was important, this face. Because if only it could be seen clearly, well, then you'd know. And so people studied what they could see of the face, and they told others what they thought they saw. Stories even arose, fantastic stories, about times that the great face had actually spoken to someone, and what the face had said. People wrote these things down, and they tried to make a list of do's and don'ts for living, but no two lists ever agreed completely. Still, they told their stories, and they listened to stories of others because there was so much at stake if only they could get it right. And as they believed that they understood the message of the great face, they tried to live in ways they thought the great face would want them to live. Usually, this wasn't very dramatic. It just meant trying to be a good person, trying to have more understanding, less prejudice, more compassion, less judgment, more love, more peace, less hate, less war, the usual things, you know. Once in a while, there would be a few people who didn't much care about any of that stuff and thought that they should just take whatever they could get, however they could get it, and might made right. But even those people, if pressed, would say, no, that's really what the face meant, too. And from time to time, there were people who said all this was just nonsense. There was no face at all carved in the stone at the top of the mountains. These were just silly myths. It was certainly true that if there was a face up there in the rocks, it was very faint. So faint that you couldn't even be sure you were seeing anything at all. And yet others would say that without that face and the stories about it, people in the valley might not have been so eager to be decent to one another. And then what kind of place would they have? After all, you needed something to live for and some kind of rules, but as any visitor could see, if there was a face at all, it was too vague to be clear about, even on a sunny day. All you could be sure of was that the people had these stories and they lived by them. Now what should they do? Should there be an expedition to the top of the mountain with a fine big camera to photograph the face once and for all? Or should they instead be paying more attention to their stories and their lives? If they could never see the face clearly or agree on it, then all they had were their stories and their lives together and their need to get along. Well, as you can tell, this isn't settled. Not in that valley, nor elsewhere. And yet there's something here of importance, and we can't seem to stop thinking about it because so much is at stake if we could just get it right. When all great religions try to teach whatever seems most profound, they always do it in stories. The great psychiatrist Rollo May wrote a book not long before he died called The Cry for Myth, where he bemoaned this same thing, this case of a people without stories worth living by. Here are some of the things he said about myths. I think they're wonderful. He said, a myth is a way of making sense in a senseless world, and all worlds are senseless until we find a story to make sense of them. Myths are narrative patterns that give significance to our lives. Myths are like beams of a house, not exposed to outside view. They're the structures that holds the thing together so that people can live in it. Myth-making is essential in gaining mental health, and the compassionate therapist will not discourage it. Indeed, the very birth and proliferation of psychotherapy in our times were called forth by the disintegration of our myths. It's quite a statement. And he has one more. Whereas empirical language refers to objective facts, myth refers to the quintessence of human experience, the meaning and significance of human lives. He also defines psychotherapy itself as the search for an adequate personal mythology. And any of you who have done therapy with clients would resonate with this. Know how important it is to get people to reframe who they think they are and how they think they're to act. It's another way of finding a better story, a myth worth living by. So what's a myth? It's a script for our life. It assigns us the story we live out and lets us feel that it's a good story. Another psychiatrist, Alfred Adler, once told these stories as our guiding fictions, and that's another great line. And a theologian I know has called the best religious stories necessary fictions. Now there's a combination of honesty and profundity. It doesn't do any good to ask whether they're true or false. That's the most irrelevant question in the world for myths. It's kind of like asking whether music is true or false, or Picasso is. You can ask whether they're good or bad, whether they're healthy or unhealthy. You can ask whether our stories are adequate or inadequate, and whether they lead us toward good lives or bad lives. Those are the questions you can bring to myths. But once they're in place, once we're living in their terms, we swear to God they're true. And we'll do unspeakable things in their defense and breathtaking things in their service. Now, in real life, myths don't sound quite so fancy, though they are. Here's what a myth can sound like in real life. Some years ago, I was the theme speaker for Unitarian Summer Camp in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, a magical place on its own. And since I was visible all week, I had people coming up to me all week who I didn't know, confiding all kinds of personal details, and some very interesting talks and some very poignant stories being shared. It was quite an honor. There were several that were good. One was a woman I spoke to, though, who said she had problems. And after we talked a while, I said, "What are your problems?" She said, "It's just one problem, really." She said, "I can't seem to do enough." Now, there's the tip of a myth. I love myths. So I said, "Tell me your story. Tell me this story you're playing out in which you can't seem to do enough." And it's a story about living in a way that gave everything everyone around her asked for. She had a lot of words in her vocabulary, but no was not one of them. She gave to her husband, to their children, to her job, to their friends, their families, their neighbors. Whatever the question was, the answer was yes. And I said, "Well, what's wrong with that?" And she said, "I'm supposed to get something back from it." And I said, "Are you sure?" I said, "Is that part of the story? You're supposed to get something back?" And she was very frustrated and said, "Yes." She said, "It's all right to give and give and give, but you have to get something back, and I'm not getting anything back, and I don't know how to do more." Now, there's a woman living in a myth that isn't gonna work. It's not a new story. It's the story of Cinderella, who gave and gave and gave and got dumped on. And what Cinderella found is what this woman was really hoping for, if she'd think about it. Because the only way you're going to win in that story is if somehow a fairy godmother shows up, who'll make you a princess, who'll punish everybody who wronged you, and make everything right in the end. And you may have noticed, I don't know how many of you have noticed this, but I'm betting most of you, there's a real shortage of fairy godmothers. It's not a good story. And the answer to her story isn't to find out a way for her to do even more. It's to find a way to change the story, to define herself in terms of different expectations and a different story. Now, you could say the role isn't always bad, and it isn't necessarily bad, and that's true. Lots and lots of people I've known and you've known, or women in situations like this, have played this same kind of role, and they do give back. They get back from their husband and their children and their family and their friends, and they're loved and treasured and cherished, and it's a full and rewarding life. And I know people like that, and so do you. So the story can work. But if it doesn't work, you need a better story. And you don't have to be a woman to identify with this story either. Here in Austin, this is the story of college students. Cinderella is the college student story. You live in rat holes for 4 or 5 years with bugs that long. Your clothes may be ratty. They're cool. They're cool. But they may be a little ratty. You buy the cheapest things you can find. You get a ride to Walmart. But the end of the story, you know, is that there's a fairy godmother, and that's called the employer. And the fairy godmother employer is going to make it all right, and you'll be rewarded for your hard work and sacrifice, and those others who didn't work hard and sacrifice won't be, and they'll work for you. This is a very famous story. You're not as distant from it as you might think. Take another story. You see a teenage boy who acts like a caricature of every macho role he's seen. He dresses that way, acts that way, talks that way. He's a little blowhard practicing to become a big blowhard. It isn't hard to figure out where he saw that story. He saw it in movies. He sees it in political posturings, cartoons, comic books, hip talk among his buddies. He can pick this story up anyway. But if he can't get the girl, or win the battle, or get the job through that kind of arrogant bluster, he'll start finding out just how short-sighted the story is and how unhelpful it is for grown-ups in a real world. It won't do to take another karate course or read another book on how to swim with the sharks and win through intimidation. He's going to need a better story with a better role for him in it. It's the only hope he's got of becoming a better person and making his world better. Now, without focusing on the story so much, though they're worth focusing on, you see how different life and religion look when you look at them this way? If religion is about the stories we're living out of, where the question we're asking is this story worth my life? Then we're in a different position. Because now we can aspire to roles as editors of stories. We can change the story. We can find better stories. We can think, since I'm going to give my life to a story anyway, wouldn't I rather have a good one? It's a whole different approach to religion and life, and I recommend it to you. You can learn more about people by learning their stories than you can through almost any other list of facts about them. You can learn more about me by learning the little silly stories that have been important to me since I was a kid than you can learn through letting me give you a list of bibliography. Much of who I am was either shaped by or attracted to, and it's probably a combination of the two. And this isn't very noble. There isn't anything here that's really very proud or noble. Two children's stories, one old fable, and an almost obscure Greek god, hardly known by anybody. I didn't even get one of the main gods. The two children's stories are The Little Red Hen and The Little Engine That Could. And I remember when I was 4 or 5 years old and read these things, and I thought, God, yes, that's right. Yes, this is true. The fable is one I heard in high school or college and hooked me immediately. And it's been the central fable and story for all of my schoolwork, all graduate work, the whole approach to religion. That's a powerful story. It's an old fable. It's from Hindus. It's the story, the Hindu story of the blind man and the elephant, where each one of the blind men, each one of the people, can only experience one tiny part of the elephant. The elephant means life. It isn't really an animal. And no one can ever know the whole thing. And so some humility is called for in our approach to religion and life, and the notion that it's going to take a lot of people at the table telling their stories to get a fuller picture of what this life thing is about. That's been the most important story for me in all my education. That's powerful stuff. And it's an old fable. And the god, I'm sorry to say, I can't see myself as the current incarnation of Krishna or Zeus or Yahweh or any of the big ones. This is a little one. I think he only got about a paragraph in Greek mythology. A little one called Proteus. And they don't even say much about him in that paragraph, except that it was some minor god who wasn't committed to any particular shape and could take the shape of anything. And Proteus has had extremely bad press in the West. Western thinkers hate him. Most of my favorite religious thinkers hate him and write against him. Psychologists write about how protean man, as they put it in the book 30 or 40 years ago, is a bad thing because it means someone with no center, no core, no integrity. And I'd read these, and since it's my God, I'm going to be very defensive. And I thought, no, you missed the whole point. This isn't what it's about at all. You missed the whole point. Protean is a wonderful thing to be. Proteus is the patron saint of people in transition. Because no matter what shape he took, he was always a god. There was always something sacred there. And the shape he was in didn't change that. That's been my patron saint for all the changes I've gone through in life. I'll get frustrated and be against the wall and then remember, wait a minute, it's just another shape. I think the fact that by the time I was 21, I'd lived in 26 places might have something to do with needing a patron saint like Proteus. Nevertheless, it's been my guiding deity ever since. I don't even think there are altars to Proteus. Or if they are, I guess they change shape all the time. You can do it in nature. You can do it in church, anywhere. It's a wonderful deity. It's also said that in Native American myths, some of the Plains Indians made shields. You can read about these and find pictures of some and even see some shields made. And these were not for defense. They were actually shields for vulnerability. They were painted on leather, not very big, and they would involve some of the key symbols of the tribes, of the key symbolic animals, and the directions, north, south, east, and west, which were all very symbolic. And what the symbols were about, the shield was a self-portrait of that person's psyche, who they were and weren't, who their strong suits were and what their weak suits were. And you're wearing that where you go. And it's a way of telling people who you are and what you need so they know how to help. Now that's amazing. And that's really what we do when we tell our stories. We're painting shields of who we are and who we aren't so that people know how to help and know who we are. I want you to do homework this week and for the next month. There'll be a test, though I'm not going to grade it. You will, so that's much worse. I want you to think about what your stories are, what your myths are. Some of you will never have known them by name before. It's an amazing discovery. Now, I won't say that this is a wonderful, edifying discovery that makes you feel wonderful, because probably they're not very famous stories. I mean, come on, the little red hen? The engine that could? A god no one's even heard of? This isn't top drawer stuff. Or Cinderella. But when you find the story, I'll guarantee you, it isn't new. It is an ancient myth, probably as old as humans, because we've always been dealing with the same things. You know, Cinderella is not a new story either. You can find it in the Greek myth going back 3,000 years of Persephone, the daughter. And the little red hen, there's nothing new in that either, except the characters. The plot's absolutely ancient. Think about it, it's exactly the same plot as the Aesop's fable of 2,500 years ago of the ant and the grasshopper. That's the little red hen story. So these things that may seem almost comical or cartoonish, I'll guarantee you they're not. They are ancient, noble myths that people have been living out forever and telling to try to learn who they are and who they aren't and what they need and where they need to go. We've always believed there's something significant about stories. And I want to leave you with the most famous story about stories, the story of Scheherazade. Not many people know about this anymore. You might remember if you played Trivial Pursuit that, oh, this is something about the 1001 Arabian Nights or something. Scheherazade was really kind of a princess, and there was a tyrant at the time who hated women for complicated reasons, and he had the combination of hatred and power that and certainty. It's always deadly. And he was in the habit of having a young woman brought to him every night. He would spend the night with her, and in the morning he'd kill her. This had gone on far too long. And the princess was excused from this because of her status, but she said, she'll take a turn, because someone has to do something to change the heart of a bad man and a madman. So she became the victim one night. And that night, before they went to sleep, she said, let me tell you a story. She was a good storyteller, and she began a wonderful story, but she wouldn't finish it. She left it hanging in midair. Well, so he let her live another night because he wanted to hear the end of the story. She was no fool. 1001 nights. That's how long the story went on. And the ending of the story, and this is where the magic of all good stories is, the ending of the story didn't happen in the story. It happened in the mind and the heart of the one she was telling the story to when the story finally reached, and she finally reached, a decent person buried inside of an evil man. And he changed and awoke, and it's a story about life. That's what good stories are about. That's why those people in the valley worked so hard to try to see what the great stone face wanted and what the stone face had said. Actually, that's a myth. There was no face up there in the stones at all. I know that because I made that story up. Maybe there was long ago, but the image is so worn away now, all that's left are the stories. They're not much. Children's stories, fables, old myths, tales, and images from sacred scriptures, even gods nobody's ever heard of. So we tell the stories as Scheherazade because we are all under the spell of Scheherazade. We all tell our stories in order to live. Maybe the people in the valley had it backwards. Maybe it was their stories and the way they lived their lives that created that great face of stone. It's still unfinished. It's still worth pondering. Let us leave this place and ponder this week. Stories worth serving. Stories worth living by. For ourselves, our relationships, our families, our nation, and our world. Because there's so much at stake if we can just get it right.